Good evening, and welcome to tonight's monthly teleconference. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question and answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. Once your question is asked, your line will be remuted. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. I would now like to turn the conference over to Lee Ann Bellum, Director of Care Management, Programs, Services, and Advocacy with the Colorado-Wyoming Chapter. Lee Ann, you may now begin.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for registering for this March monthly teleconference. We're so pleased to have you all on the line with us this evening. This teleconference is one of the many free and helpful chapter programs and services available to people living with MS. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. You can always contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867 and press option 1. Treatments for MS are progressing at a remarkable rate, with more potential therapies in the pipeline than at any other time in history. During this interactive teleconference, you will learn about current and cutting-edge drugs around multiple sclerosis and receive practical advice based on these findings from our featured guest speaker, Dr. Roger Cook. Dr. Cook is a neurologist and the medical director at the Providence Holy Family MS Center in Spokane, and clinical associate professor for University of Washington. He joined Providence Holy Family in November 2007 after previously being in private practice neurology. Dr. Cook currently chairs the National MS Society Inland Northwest Chapter's Clinical Advisory Committee, chairing the committee since 2007. He was inducted into National MS Society's Volunteer Hall of Fame in the Health Professional and Researchers category in 2009 for his contributions as a volunteer. Following this evening's teleconference, you will receive a program evaluation by email, which we urge you to complete as your feedback and ideas are very important to us. Within that email, you will receive information about our upcoming teleconferences and other chapter programs and services available to you. On that note, I thank you again for being on this call this evening and would like to hand the call over to Dr. Roger Cook. Go ahead, Dr. Cook.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm speaking to you from my office, actually, in Spokane at Providence Hospital, Holy Family Hospital. I'm going to comment about two major therapeutic groups, immunologic drugs that are used to treat the underlying process, we think, in multiple sclerosis, and then symptomatic treatment. I think I'll start with the immunologic treatments and a little history, and then open it up for questions about that, and then as time permits, we'll talk about symptomatic treatment. Well, as you probably know, until 1993, we didn't really have specific treatments for multiple sclerosis. Sometimes steroids were used, of course, and sometimes chemotherapy like Cytoxan was used. But the development of beta-seron was the first drug specifically for multiple sclerosis shown by a clinical trial that you could decrease relapse rate about a third by using this interferon beta preparation. And it's pretty much the same as human interferon beta, which our body makes to protect us against virus infections, except it had one amino acid substitution. And it is a useful drug, but it does have a slightly increased tendency to produce antibodies to itself, so sometimes it doesn't work for certain people. In 1996, Avonex came on the market, which is also interferon beta, but its amino acid sequence is the same as human interferon exactly, so it's less likely to produce antibodies. And as you know, the beta seron is given under the skin every other day, whereas Avonex is given once a week in the muscle. And I understand that there's soon going to be a new needle that can be used with an injector like they have for the subcutaneous drugs, so people don't have to self-inject or go to a clinic to have the injection. Also, I think in late 96, early 97, Copaxone came on the market, and that was a totally different type of drug. It's glatiramer acetate. It's really a mixture of polypeptides made originally in Israel and still made by Teva Corporation, which has, of course, branches in the United States. But it works in a different principle. Basically, if you really want to be simplistic, it's sort of like desensitizing your body to myelin, sort of like an allergy shot in a sense. And it's quite a safe drug, and it has different side effects, of course, than interferons. And then head-to-head studies in recent years have shown that both really work quite similarly over long periods of time in reducing relapses and disease progression, although experts would argue that we haven't really proven how much they do over the full lifetime of a person. Nevertheless, the trends are a friend. I think they have helped people. About 2001, Rebif came on the market, which is interferon beta-1A also, like Avonex, very similar, only it's given under the skin 3 times a week. So you get a bigger dose of interferon with Rebif than you do with Avonex. And there's some evidence, at least, that the interferons, especially the higher dose interferons, probably decrease the MRI new lesion activity more than Copaxone. But in the long run, clinically, the benefits are about the same for both classes of drugs, glatiramer acetate or Copaxone and interferon. And actually, there's yet another interferon called Xtavia, which is the same drug, really, as Betaseron, just marketed by a different pharmaceutical company. Then in late 2004, natalizumab came on the market, Tysabri, which is an infusion every 4 weeks. And it works on a little different principle. It's a monoclonal antibody that binds to a receptor on white cells, lymphocytes, activated lymphocytes, so they can't get through the blood-brain barrier into the brain where they cause inflammation. And it turns out that this drug is quite effective. It's more effective in terms of relapse reduction and MRI changes than the other drugs we've already mentioned. But the problem with that drug, as you probably recall, was that it caused some fatal brain infections with a virus called the JC virus. It's John Coleman virus. And so that made some people worry about taking it for lengthy periods of time, at least. As it turns out, we can now test indirectly for the JC virus. About half of people in the population have this virus in their body, probably in their kidneys and bone marrow, and half don't. So we can do a study. It's called an antibody study, JC viral antibody study, to see if people are at higher risk to develop this infection. And the current statistics are that if you don't have this virus in your body, your chance of getting this PML or brain infection are almost zero. Probably not zero because the test isn't perfect. There may be a 3% false negative rate on the test. And some people do convert from negative to positive also every year, maybe 1 or 2%. Anyway, we continue to monitor these people by doing this test every year. If a person has been on immunologic suppressant drugs like azathioprine or methotrexate or mitoxantrone, novantrone, they have even more increased risk of developing this brain infection. So those are the kind of people we'd probably consider taking off Tysabri after they'd been on it, say, 2 years. After 2 years, the risk does seem to go up to get this brain infection. But anyway, we still use a lot of Tysabri for people who have had relapses while on these other drugs, the interferons and Copaxone. It varies from clinic to clinic, but I would say between 5 and 10% of our patients are and in other clinics are on Tysabri. Now, most recently, in September of 2010, Gilenya fingolimod came on the market, the first oral treatment for multiple sclerosis. And this drug, again, showed better relapse reduction benefit than the older drugs, the interferon and Copaxone. But this drug has perhaps slightly more risk because it's more of an immunosuppressant. This drug works by binding to a receptor that keeps the lymphocytes in the lymph nodes so they can't get out and get across the blood-brain barrier and cause inflammation in the brain. But by doing that, they decrease immune surveillance in your body, so you're somewhat more prone to certain infections like herpetic infections. So before you would ever take this drug, you'd want to be sure you had adequate antibodies, say, to the shingles virus, the herpes zoster virus, which is the chickenpox virus. And if you didn't have adequate antibodies, you'd want to get an immunization, the shingles immunization, before you started this drug. This drug can also cause swelling in the eye. So people with diabetes, with diabetic eye disease, would be a little more risk to develop the swelling. So we need to do screening eye tests before and then after starting this drug. Also, this drug can slow the heart rate. It binds the receptors on the heart. So the patient has to be monitored for about 6 hours after the first dose. It's a first dose effect usually. And this drug should not be used with beta blockers, drugs like propranolol, atenolol, that are used sometimes for hypertension and certain cardiac arrhythmias. So we do get EKGs on people before starting this drug. In other words, this drug is a little harder to use in a sense when you start it than the others. The great benefit, of course, is it's a pill once a day rather than these injections. In terms of imminent approval of new drugs, I understand that BG12, which is a fumarate that's been used in Germany for psoriasis for a number of years, may get approved within the next year. This is another drug produced by the Biogen company, which makes Tysabri and Avonex. And the reports that came in our meeting in Amsterdam last October indicate that this does have good benefit with seemingly mild side effects. And the nice thing about it is we already have a track record of safety because it's been used in Europe, in Germany at least, I think, for 15, 20 years for psoriasis. Actually, I have a few patients with psoriasis, and this may be the ideal drug for them eventually. Anyway, it's not on the market yet. And there are other drugs that are potentially coming on the market within the next year. Lequinimod is another such drug. Alemtuzumab, Campath, maybe get on the market. That's a very powerful drug that has a very prolonged effect. So the concern there, of course, is, again, autoimmune dysfunction. There's been cases of thyroid dysfunction and decreased platelet count on that drug. So they have to be monitored more carefully. It's actually on the market for certain malignancies, but it's not been approved for use with multiple sclerosis yet. And then there's also evidence that another B-cell depleting drug, rituximab, can help multiple sclerosis. A major trial was completed a few years ago that showed benefit, but again, it hasn't been approved for primary MS use. It is used now for neuromyelitis optica, which is a disease related to multiple sclerosis, but different in several ways also. Some patients in the past, more I would say, have used adjunctive drugs such as methotrexate and azathioprine along with interferons and Copaxone. I personally haven't used that combination very often. Some people have also used statin drugs, although there was one paper that suggested that statin drugs such as Lipitor combined with interferons could possibly decrease the effect of the interferon. that doesn't seem to be the case with Copaxone. So there may be some synergism there. Some of you may be interested in clinical trials. There is a good site to go to on the internet called clinicaltrials.gov, and it lists many, many different MS trials. You go on there and just type in multiple sclerosis, and it'll give you a long list of clinical trials going on around the country with their sites and so forth. Another good source of information, of course, is the National MS Society internet site. Another hopeful new drug is called Anti-Lingo, and we think that may enhance repair mechanisms, allowing oligodendrocytes to regenerate from precursor, not regenerate, but go from precursor oligodendrocytes to functioning oligodendrocytes, which could remyelinate stripped axons that cause the symptoms of multiple sclerosis. As you know, for years we thought it was primarily simply demyelination, but we know now that there is loss of gray matter as well in multiple sclerosis. And Dr. Trapp at Cleveland Clinic showed that in a nice paper about 14 years ago, actually, of axonal transection. And we know that brains of people that have MS do shrink a little faster than normal, so there is loss of cells going on that may be above and beyond what you'd expect just simply from demyelinization. So the newer drugs, we hope, will address this and help repair the damage that's already done. Right now, I would say our drugs are more geared to decreasing inflammation. So as you might expect, these drugs are best used early in the disease. And you've probably heard the term clinically isolated syndrome. Basically, all that is a description that someone presents with a symptom, say decreased vision in one eye like optic neuritis. They get an MRI scan that shows other white matter lesions, and they could still be diagnosed with multiple sclerosis by the new criteria from 2010. Based on their MRI, especially if there's initially an enhancing and non-enhancing lesion along with the symptom. So these people probably have had MS and didn't realize it, and now we can call them actually having MS and start treatment. And early treatment seems to work better than late treatment, especially on this inflammatory component. Let me stop there for a minute and see if there's any questions about these basic drugs. I'll be glad to try to tell you what we do and answer any other question you have. The bottom line is we want to balance benefit versus side effects when we pick these drugs, and they all have some side effects. Maybe I'll comment just a minute about side effects. Interferons, oftentimes called flu-like side effects, aches and pains, which can be mitigated with anti-inflammatory drugs and Tylenol, and sometimes they go away, and I have patients that say they never have those side effects. The big complaint with Copaxone usually is an injection site reaction, either swelling, redness, or dimpling, lipoatrophy. So some people don't like that because it can sometimes be somewhat disfiguring. Usually not a major problem, but sometimes. So now we have more options, and then we have to have the discussion of risk-reward about these other side effects that I mentioned about decreasing immune surveillance. So let's go ahead and open it up for some questions. Hello? Hello?
Dr. Cook?
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe Kelly, our moderator, isn't
on. I'm sorry.
On.
Oh. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the number 1 key on your telephone. Our first question comes from Jean. Jean, you may begin.
Yes, is that me?
Yes, hello.
Hello. I have primary progressive MS, and I was just wondering, all I ever read about, all the treatments that are being worked on and everything, it's always about relapsing and remitting. Is there anything being developed for primary progressive at this point?
Well, this has been a big problem. You're exactly right. There have been trials with various drugs. I think the interferons, Copaxone, and rituximab have all been tried, and none of them have proven definitely to benefit. I think in the rituximab trial, which was about 3 years ago, they showed some benefit early on in males only, but it wasn't enough that it got approved for this use. So we think that primary progressive MS may be a different disease, more of an oligodendrocyte disease perhaps than an inflammatory disease, maybe a primary oligodendrocyte disease as opposed to inflammation from an outside trigger like a virus. It's the minority of patients that have primary progressive, and it's always hard for me to decide who truly has primary progressive, because when I see people that have multiple lesions in their MRI brain scans, some of which may enhance, even though they don't have definite attacks, clinical attacks, relapses and remissions, it suggests to me that they probably do have a form of relapsing remitting disease, and I would treat them as relapsing remitting. As you probably know, they usually say 85% of people have relapsing remitting disease. So unfortunately, right now, my main emphasis in treating people with primary progressive is treating their symptoms. And it's usually a slowly progressive, more spinal cord type picture with spasticity and weakness of the legs, clumsiness, not so much visual loss or necessarily cognitive impairment or other more central brain related problems. So we would probably, and we'll get to talk about symptoms later, we'd be using drugs like baclofen and tizanidine and perhaps 4-aminopyridine, which we can talk about under the symptom part of my presentation. Brand name Ampira, but you can get generic also. But unfortunately, I don't have any really promising drug to tell you about. Perhaps one of these newer drugs that aren't on the market yet will prove to be effective for primary progressive. And I admit, sometimes I'll treat what seems to be primary progressive with one of these standard drugs anyway to see if it helps. The trial, I think I sub-trial with natalizumab or Tysabri didn't show definite benefit either. And these drugs, as you know, are very expensive, and they do have some side effects. So without proven efficacy, we don't generally put people on immunomodulating or suppressive drugs for that. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Mary Lou. Mary Lou, you may begin.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. Guess what? I found out when you said when Avonex was put into the way, I've been on it for 16 years. Is there some other drug I can now go on?
Is there another drug you could go on?
Yes.
Well, of course, you haven't been on Copaxone or any of the others, just Avonex?
Well, I started with Betaseron, and then they put me on Avonex when it first came out.
And you're doing well? You're stable?
Well, not as good as I used to.
Well, as you probably know, they estimate that it probably at least 50% of people after 10 to 15 years do get into the so-called secondary phase of multiple sclerosis, where they don't have the clear-cut relapses and remissions. They just gradually get somewhat worse. And again, it's like the primary progressive. We don't seem to have drugs that really arrest that, that stop that. The only drug that was ever approved for that was Novantrone. And we don't use Novantrone much anymore because it can cause heart damage and it increases the risk of leukemia almost up to a 1% risk. It's an immunosuppressant drug and it's dose limited. You can only take so much and then you have to stop. If someone's truly having secondary progressive disease with relapses, I think it does help the inflammatory component and shut that down. But in terms of switching from Avonex, well, that's low-dose interferon, basically. If you were not doing well, you could either consider Rebif, which is higher-dose interferon beta-1A, or you might consider switching to Copaxone. Some people respond better to Copaxone than interferons. Or you possibly could consider Gilenya, the pill. Like I say, you have to get the screening test. If you have no heart disease or eye disease or severe pulmonary disease and you got immunity to the herpes zoster virus, then you could go on that. So we have been switching a few people. It's often patient-driven. They get tired of taking these injections and want to switch. In some countries, more likely in Canada or maybe European countries, some MS experts actually take people completely off these drugs because they say, well, the inflammatory component of your disease has run its course. Let's treat your symptoms and get you off these injectable drugs. So time will tell. We think there may be some underlying smoldering inflammation still in people that seem to have stable MRI scans and stable clinical courses on these drugs. So in general, in the United States, I'd say people tend to stay on these drugs indefinitely. But some people get tired of it or have side effects or can't afford it. And I'm happy to follow those patients, treat them symptomatically, and see how they do. If they have a flare-up, we can give them steroids and put them back on immunotherapy again. So some people actually do go off drug. I hope that's somewhat helpful.
Our next question comes from Susan. Susan, you may begin.
Actually, my question was the same as the first question. I have primary progressive, so you answered it.
Yeah, I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer. Thank you.
Phil. Our next question is from Phil. Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, we also had the first question, why pass progressive, so it was answered. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Diane. Diane, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
I sort of had the same question as the one person. I've had the relapsing remitting, and I've been told in the last year that it's secondary progressive. And
yeah, I have a number of people in your situation, and like I say, I try to emphasize the symptomatic treatment, including exercise, of course, and sometimes yoga and physical therapy, occupational therapy, assistive devices. One thing I didn't mention is I recommend for everybody out there to take vitamin D, D3. There's evidence that it definitely has some beneficial effect in MS, and it also helps prevent MS. So I'd encourage all of you to put your children on vitamin D. And I would say at least 2,000 units a day. We're finding many people need 4,000 units a day. As you know, for many years, it was kind of a mystery why people that live farther from the equator had more MS. And now we think it's because during the winter, of course, the sun is less available. And even the sun that is out, it's filtered by the angle of the tilt of the Earth. So our skin doesn't make enough vitamin D, and they've done studies that show that people's vitamin D levels go down in the winter, and so in the spring they have very low levels. And a lot of my patients have extremely low levels of vitamin D. So it's a pretty safe thing to take, vitamin D3, cholecalciferol. And I start usually with 2,000 units per day, but for many people, I say 4,000, sometimes even 5,000. I think it's pretty safe. It's rare that it would cause high serum calcium and kidney stones. So everybody with MS, I would recommend take vitamin D3 at least 2,000, and also their children, because the children of people with MS do have a higher risk of MS. It's partly a genetic disease, as you know. It's about a 2% risk of a child getting MS whose parent has MS.
Our next question comes from Ida. Ida, you may begin.
Hi, doctor. I didn't hear you mention if somebody wanna from Evernex to go to beta serum just to make it a little bit stronger.
Some people do escalate the dose. They go from Avonex, which is low dose, 30 micrograms per week, to Rebif, say, which is 44 micrograms three times a week, or beta-seron. I tend not to use as much beta-seron just because it has more chance of producing antibodies against the drug itself. And this has been controversial for years, but the consensus now worldwide, I think, is that antibodies do make a difference. If you have persistent antibodies, I usually check at least 3 months apart and see if they persist. If a person has persistent neutralizing antibodies, that means the drug is probably not working effectively or not fully effectively, and so at least you're not getting full benefit from the drug. And so why take a really expensive drug if it's really not fully effective, since there are alternatives? More in the past, I would say someone that was not doing well on Avonex would go to a higher dose, either beta-seron in the old days, that was the original drug in 1993, or Rebif, which has been on the market the last 10 years or so.
Our next question comes from Anne. Anne, you may begin.
Yes, my question is about, and I'm not sure if you mentioned this when you were talking about your combination drugs, but do you have any information about combining low-dose naltrexone in combination along with Copaxone?
Well, I always put naltrexone into the more of the symptomatic treatment category. There may be some minimal evidence that it has some immunologic effect, but some people take it, 3 milligrams or 4.5 milligrams at bedtime, and they say it makes them feel better. As you know, it's a narcotic antagonist, and so it has some narcotic effect, but it's a very low dose. I think it's quite safe. I think the group at University of California, San Francisco, has done the most studies on this. And there may be some placebo effect, too, of course. But if it helps people sleep, first of all, that's going to make people feel better right there. I have no objection to it. I don't think it does harm. I think has to be compounded. It's off-label use. I don't think there's a brand name of it. But, yeah, I would say that would be fine to use in combination with one of the immunologic drugs.
Our next question comes from Glenna. Glenna, you may begin.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I have a question. Recently, my Avonex was, I got it through Biogen, and they stopped it because the people who are on stopped giving refills to people who are on Medicare replacement insurance, that they won't supply it any longer. Do you know, I know you mentioned Rebif and Copaxone. Is there any other drug that would be similar if I'm not on Avonex anymore?
Well, Rebif is basically the same drug, same amino acid sequence. It's formulated slightly differently, so it's given under the skin instead of in the muscle. So Rebif could certainly be substituted for Avonex. Yeah, I'm surprised that your insurance did that. I hadn't run into that problem recently. But you could certainly use Rebif instead. Copaxone, I could say, works, but it's a different drug. It's not an interferon like Avonex.
Our next question comes from Teddy. Teddy, you may begin.
Yeah. What clinical trials are there for symptom management?
For symptom management?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Most of the trials, of course, want to be immunologic, treating the underlying disease, so-called disease-modifying drugs. Well, I think a lot of these trials are sort of certain clinics try a certain thing for a while to see if it helps. Like I think the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale has been doing a trial for fatigue using plain old aspirin. Dr. Vingerchuk down there, I think, is in charge of that. And I haven't heard the final outcome. The idea, I think, there was if you lower body temperature slightly, that maybe that would help the fatigue. Personally, when I treat fatigue, which is probably the most common symptom in MS, I go through a variety of things, and I haven't found any one that always works. We usually at least try amantadine, the old drug amantadine, twice a day, and it helps some people. If that doesn't work, if they have good insurance, sometimes you can get Provigil or Nuvigil. I would say the biggest one we use in our clinic is methylphenidate. You know, brand name is Ritalin, but methylphenidate generic is relatively cheap. It's off-label use. Most insurances will cover it. Because fatigue can lead to lots of other problems. It can lead to more pain, of course, and cognitive problems. Napping, so people can't work full time. I would say sometimes this 4-aminopyridine can help fatigue, but as it is, Ampira, which is the brand name of it, is only approved for improved walking. It's not approved for fatigue. Dr. Elliot Frohman at University of Texas sometimes says that acetylcarnitine helps. It's an over-the-counter drug. You take a gram twice a day. I've had a few people say that seemed to help them. Of course, probably the biggest one is caffeine. You know, people drink coffee or take five-hour energy drink, things like that. You don't want to overdo that because that can cause side effects too. The 4-aminopyridine can be helpful, I think, in some people. So we use it off-label. We have a compounding pharmacy that makes it in low doses. Could you repeat your question one more time so I make sure I understood?
Teddy, go ahead.
You answered my question.
I did? Okay, good.
Our next question comes from Sherry. Sherry, go ahead.
Yeah, you had talked about Ampura and you can get it compounded. How would you go about getting that compounded? And Medicare is kind of backing out of being helpful with our medications.
Okay, this is a complicated story. There's a company called Acorda that did a trial. It cost them a lot of money, I'm sure, to prove that 4-aminopyridine helped MS symptoms, and they proved it by showing that people walked a little better, at least some patients walked better on this drug. So they got a name attached to it, and the FDA approved it for 10 milligrams long-acting twice a day. The insurance companies, including Medicare and so forth, won't pay for off-label use of drugs, and they consider the generic form, 4-aminopyridine, which has been around for many years, I've used it for many years in my practice, to be an unproven treatment for these other symptoms like fatigue or slowed thinking or clumsiness of the arms, a variety of things. And it might help. It doesn't help everybody. It probably helps less than 50% of people I give it to, but the ones that it helps, they really like it. The other nice thing about compounding is I can give it at a lower dose. I can start, say, with 5 milligrams twice a day because some people get dizzy when they first take this drug. I've had some people even on 2.5 milligrams twice a day. The good news is, at least in Spokane, at our compounding pharmacy, the total cost, not a copay, total cost for a month's supply is about $40. So then people have to decide, is it worth $40? What I do is give them a month's trial. If it seems to help and they're enthusiastic, it's worth it to spend $40. For others, it didn't do anything. They just drop it. But so far, we've been able to do it. I've been told by the compounding pharmacy that there's now a shortage worldwide, nationwide, locally at least, of 4-aminopyridine. So far, we haven't run out, but it's becoming a problem. So people that have good insurance and have some benefit in their walking, then we give them Ampira, 10 milligrams BID. The cost differential is tremendous. The cost of Ampira is over $1,000 a month, retail.
Our next question comes from Don. Don, you may begin.
Hello?
Don.
Hello?
Our next question comes from Sue. Sue, you may begin.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
I was diagnosed for sure with MS in July of 2006, but I'm blessed with a very slow kind, although I'm 76 years old now, and I've been told that I might have it for the last 40 years. And then I had two doses of Novantrin in 2006, and then nothing else at all until the last 6 or 8 months, and now the doctor, I'm in Apache Junction, Arizona now, but we live in Washington, but the doctor is giving me Tysabri. And I've had one infusion 2 weeks ago, and I go back another 2 weeks. And I don't really know a lot about it. I've got a lot of information. They send you all kinds of stuff to read, and I don't know if anybody else that's had it or that proves of it or anything.
You're talking about Tysabri?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I would say you're at a little higher risk of developing this brain infection if you had Novantron, even though you only had two doses. Do you know your JC antibody test results, your antibody test results?
I don't know if I've ever had that done. I really don't know.
Yeah, you should have that done because if you're JC antibody positive and have had Novantron, then your risk of developing this PML may be as high as 1%. And you say you're 76 years old, so it's a little odd to present that late in life, frankly. Like he said, you've probably had the disease a long time. I don't know all the details. It's always hard to advise people without knowing all the details, but if you had active lesions on your skin, a lot of oligoclonal bands in your spinal fluid, and maybe you truly are having an inflammatory phase of disease, then it's worth being aggressive. But Tysabri is a pretty powerful drug, and we don't use it first line usually. We usually start with interferon or Copaxone, and then if failing that, we switch to Tysabri. So I'd have to know more. Your situation sounds a little unusual, I would say. There's certainly a lot of information on Tysabri on the Internet, the Biogen site itself or the National MS Society site. But I never like to advise people to get second opinions, but you might want to get a second opinion.
Our next question comes from Kristen. Kristen, you may begin.
Yes, hi. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. I've been diagnosed with MS last year, and my doctor was going to put me on Gilenya right away. After I had my eyes checked, they discovered a toxoplasmosis in my right eye, and I was told by the retina specialist not to take any medication that suppresses the immune system. Therefore, the doctor took me off the medication, and a couple of months later, after there was no progression in my brain MRI, he said, I don't think I can give you a definite diagnosis of MS at this point. So for one, I would like to know, is there any other drug out there that does not suppress the immune system? And then second, can you give me a diagnosis and then a couple months later take it back just because there are no hot spots on the brain and there is no progression?
Okay, well, let's talk about diagnosing MS. First of all, there is no one simple, perfect test to diagnose MS. First of all, usually nothing is attempted, no tests are done until someone has a symptom. The most sensitive test for picking up an abnormality is MRI. 95% plus people with MS are going to have probably an abnormality either in their brain or spinal cord on MRI. The second most useful test, in my opinion, is the spinal fluid, where you look for signs of inflammation, oligoclonal banding, that sort of thing. In general, I do not start people on Gilenya unless for some reason they were just adamant that they were not going to take an injectable drug. I still treat Gilenya as a second line, like Tysabri. It's a good drug. It's more effective head-to-head, at least at 1 year, than Avonex. But I usually start with the safer, older drugs, the interferons or Copaxone, rather than Gilenya. And the difference is, these other drugs, the earlier drugs, Avonex, Copaxone, Betaseron, Rebif, are called immunomodulators. They're not really immunosuppressants. They don't damage your immune system and make you more vulnerable to infections. And even Tysabri is not truly an immunosuppressant. It works in a very specific way to block cells from getting into the central nervous system. Gilenya is more of an immunosuppressant. As you probably know, it keeps these lymphocytes in the lymph nodes so they can't get out and circulate. And certainly one of the side effects of Gilenya is macular edema, the swelling in the eye that can cause, I guess, severe visual loss. And if first people developed it, then they have to be taken off immediately. So people that have diabetic eye disease have to be monitored very closely. And I don't know enough about toxoplasmosis of the eye that I would venture any statement about that, other than I would take your retinal doctor's advice and not use Gilenya. But there are certainly other options. In terms of diagnosing it, sure, if you do serial MRIs on people with MS, they're going to change. Sometimes there'll be enhancing lesions, sometimes there won't. The enhancement only lasts for maybe 6-8 weeks, maybe 3 months at the most. Then the enhancement goes away. And then the lesion may go away, your brain repairs itself, or there may be scar formation. Then you get a plaque, a long-term white spot in your brain. So the history is key. Have you had more than one episode that would suggest relapses and remissions? Have they looked at your spinal cord? That's another place. Have they looked at your spinal fluid? Do you have signs of inflammation and so-called oligoclonal banding or an increased IgG index? Have you had, well, because of your eye disease, I don't know if it would be helpful, but another useful test is the visual evoked potential, where you look at a checkerboard on a TV and they measure how long it takes for the signal to get to your eye back to the back part of your brain. It's sort of like an EEG. But that gives you a clue, do you have optic nerve disease in addition to brain disease per se? So there sounds like there's some work to be done, but I would definitely heed your retinal doctor's advice.
Our next question comes from Mona. Mona, you may begin.
Yes, Dr. Cook. You've answered my questions with the previous callers, and you've been most helpful, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from Robert. Robert, you may begin.
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Cook. I've got, you answered most of my questions because somebody had primary progressive MS, which I was diagnosed years ago, but I haven't had anything major except recently. I've had a few falls, and the last fall I had, I don't know why, but I lost all my strength, and I had to call the fire department just to come so someone can lift me off the floor and place me on the couch. You know, I mean, I just lost all strength. I couldn't even go to my walker. And, but now, you know, that was for a short time. And, the major thing with me with MS, and I was diagnosed with it from the VA years ago, and I went and got second opinions, fifth opinions, because I couldn't believe at my age, and this is quite a few years ago, that I was diagnosed with MS. And, you know, I just, and a lot of them, a lot of doctors, it's a hard call to make. And I understand that. And they said, but I had the, you know, with the brain, I got the lesion there, and I got one lesion by my spine. And so I went down to VA in Sacramento, and neurology down there, the head of neurology, they said they'll step up to the plate and say you got primary progressive MS. But I haven't had any, like, anything major for, and then supposedly I've had it for a lot of years. So
yeah,
I don't know.
The only thing really that I take, no
shots or anything. I'm just taking this carbenzine because I had some twitching in the left side of my jaw when I was eating, and I take those pills 3 times a day, and so far, except I got to watch myself about falling, and my right leg is stiff, and I use a walker, and other than that, that's it. I'm just worried about if my kids or my son or daughter or my granddaughter would they be a target for this?
Well, offhand, I don't know the genetics of primary progressive versus MS overall. As I mentioned earlier, overall, it's about a 2% risk of your kids. I'd have your kids at least take vitamin D as a preventative. It's the only preventative we know right now. And for you, I think symptomatic treatment, drugs like baclofen, tizanidine. Some people that have severe spasticity of their legs, stiffness and falls like that, can benefit from baclofen pumps, where they actually put a very low dose into the spinal fluid directly so they don't have the side effects of the pills. And it improves, at least decreases discomfort in the legs. And as far as sharp shooting type pains that can occur with MS, neuropathic pains, we sometimes use anti-seizure drugs like Tegretrol, I think you mentioned. A lot of times we use gabapentin, Neurontin for that. Sometimes the tricyclic drugs help, amitriptyline, nortriptyline, even cyclobenzaprine, which can also help spasticity. Well, one general comment, since time is running out here, on symptom management. One thing to remember is that when you have new symptoms, sometimes they're not a sign of a relapse. It's called a pseudo-relapse, pseudo-exacerbation. It can be caused by infection, where your body temperature goes up a little bit, even a half a degree. It's a well-known phenomenon. In fact, in the old days, they used to do a test for MS where they put people in a hot bath and see if it brought out numbness or weakness or double vision, that sort of thing, blurred vision. So if you're overheated, if you live in a hot climate on a hot summer day, you're outside in the bright sun without a cooling vest or whatever, your symptoms could get temporarily worse. So you want to stay cool with cool drinks, ice drinks, cooling collars, cooling vests, cooling hats, even get in the shade, get in air conditioning. And one of the first things I always check when someone's having a flare-up of symptoms is urine, because a lot of people have bladder infections they don't realize that they have. There may not be pain on urination or blood in the urine, but if you do a urine culture, they actually do have a urinary tract infection, and antibiotics will help that and also help the flare-ups of the neurological symptoms. And, of course, people get viral infections, and that can bring on a pseudo-exacerbation. So treating the symptoms just in these simple ways sometimes can help significantly. Also, you want to make sure that you don't have other problems such as thyroid dysfunction. Some of these drugs, interferons can sometimes affect the thyroid function, so that should be checked periodically. That can cause fatigue. People should be checked to make sure they don't have B12 deficiencies. Some people have low B12 levels. There's another autoimmune disease that can cause malabsorption of B12, or if someone's had bowel surgery. Some people may be anemic. So those things need to be corrected also. But bladder problems are common. Just a brief comment on that. A lot of you probably take one of the bladder drugs if you have frequency of urination, a spastic bladder. The so-called anti-muscarinic drugs help, like oxybutynin, which is generic and quite inexpensive. There's Detrol, Doltaridine, Vesicare, Sulvedacin. You probably know these brand names easier, Vesicare, Detrol, and oxybutynin is, can't think of the name of it now. Anyway, I would say I use oxybutynin the most commonly. And it can cause dry mouth. It can occasionally cause urinary retention. Some people that can't empty their bladders fully sometimes learn to catheterize themselves. So if they're going out on a date or something, or at bedtime, they catheterize themselves to empty their bladder. And then they can sleep longer, better. Of course, if you get up at night 3 or 4 times, you're going to be tired during the day. So it can help fatigue and indirectly as well. And there are drugs that can help that also. Doxycycline, for example, Flomax. So any questions about symptomatic treatment? Last minute questions here.
Our next question comes from David. David, you may begin.
Yeah, how you doing, doctor? Thank you very much.
Sure.
My question, actually, I was, I'm relapsing remitting, but last October, November, I couldn't walk. It was freaking horrible and very scary. And I was thinking it could be possible I was going to secondary progressive. And so, but the scary thing is that right now there is no drugs. Is there a type of medication? I mean, are there a type of vitamin or that you recommend besides D3? Because I know I changed my diet dramatically, and I can walk now, thank God. But is there something that you see as far as vitamins besides D3 that you can take as well to help out a little bit, you know?
Well, the only drug that I would just make a blanket statement that probably does no harm and it might do some good is vitamin B12. A lot of people have just sort of borderline B12 levels, like 300. I don't think it hurts to take 500 micrograms or even 1,000 micrograms of vitamin B12 per day. At the worst, you just urinate it out. It's stored in your liver for a long, long time. But usually just oral supplementation of B12 is adequate. You don't need injectable B12. But in general, I don't just recommend taking a bunch of general vitamins. Some vitamins can actually be harmful. If you take too much, say, vitamin B6, you can actually get a neuropathy. If you take too much vitamin A, you can get visual symptoms and even confusion. I think vitamin D is quite safe. There was a recent article about someone that got a high serum calcium and got confused, but that's very unusual. Think about it. When we're out in the sun, our bodies make like 10,000 units of vitamin D in half an hour if you're in a short sleeve shirt on a summer day. So our bodies have learned to handle vitamin D and store it. It's just, but most people, like I say, that live far from the equator and don't get outside a whole lot, and plus they put on sunscreen, tend to have low vitamin D levels. But other than that, I don't have any specific recommendation. It's sometimes hard to know when people go from relapsing remitting to secondary progressive. Basically, the relapses seem to stop, but they slowly seem to get worse. And so, like I say, there's probably many things going on in MS that we don't fully understand. At first, there seems to be inflammation. You see the white spots on the MRI. But there's probably a smoldering something else going on, you know, that's damaging some of the neurons, so you get the shrinkage, this atrophy effect, so-called neurodegeneration effect. And so far, we haven't had a good drug for that. We think that this drug, perhaps anti-lingo, may help regenerate these oligodendrocytes and help repair the central nervous system. And we didn't talk about stem cells, but there's some evidence that stem cells derived from a person's own bone marrow grown up in a lab and then put back in your body possibly could lead to regeneration of some of the nerve cells and oligodendrocytes perhaps, and it's relatively safe. The total ablation treatments, where you completely destroy the immune system and then rebuild it, has significant risk, as you know, so it's not used routinely for MS. So it would have to be extremely severe MS and done at a research place that does a lot of it. Any other questions?
Our next question comes from Lynn. Lynn, you may begin.
Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. I've been having little slight tremors. So my question is, I was diagnosed in 2003. I couldn't walk for 6 months. I'm walking well now. But I am noticing that I'm starting to have little tremors. Wondering if there's anything I can take for that, or should I just leave it be? Because it's not, I can't hold a pot. You know, I can hold it, but my hand tremors, and I never had tremors before. So I know it's a part of the MS.
Is the tremor more when you do something, like try to write something or hold a cup or something like that, or is it just shaking at rest?
No, like when I go to pick up something, or like if I try to hold a pot, or even when I'm writing, you know, my writing is not, I used to have beautiful writing, and I don't have that beautiful writing anymore. I have to really take my time, and sometimes if I'm listening to something and trying to get it down, I don't have time to do that. And I'm a woman that was a manager, you know, an administrator, and was over 80 employees, and so I'm really, you know, it hurts me that I can't do much in my personal life, but when I was in my career, I was great at it, and now I'm damaged and can't do, you know, I can do for myself, but like tremors, you know, it's like, what is this, you know, why is it I can't write like I should be able to write? It's slowed down, you know what I'm saying? So I want to know if there's something that I can do. Is there an exercise, or what would you recommend?
Well, first of all, the tremor may be secondary to the multiple sclerosis. The most common cause of tremor is actually essential tremor. It's a tendency some people are born with. Remember Katharine Hepburn, the actress, had a familial essential tremor. Her head would shake and her hands would shake, her voice would shake. Even Ronald Reagan had a head tremor. He probably had an essential tremor. That's actually the most common cause of tremor. And that does respond to some drugs like primidone. Start with a very low dose because it's going to make you very sleepy. Or beta blockers. If you don't have asthma, you could try a beta blocker like propranolol. But it's a hard one to treat for MS itself. If it's really severe and it affects the dominant side of the body and it's really incapacitating, sometimes you can get deep brain stimulators put in by neurosurgeons to control the tremor. I've seen that help a few people. But it's a hard thing to treat. I usually start with the primidone, like 25 milligrams at bedtime, and gradually work the dose up. And sometimes that'll help. And sometimes the beta blockers will help, like propranolol, but you have to start low and work up. Usually you need at least 80 milligrams, but be sure you don't have asthma because it can flare up asthma. So they're worth clinical trials, and some people may have a mixture of a familial or essential tremor plus the effect of the MS itself. But if it's purely MS-related, it's a hard thing to treat in my experience. One simple thing, somewhat simple thing anyway, is just wearing a heavy bracelet to dampen the tremor, just using gravity to dampen the tremor. So some people do that, wear little wrist weights. If you got a nice big gold bracelet, you can try that.
Our next question comes from Michelle. Michelle, you may begin.
Hi. I actually was asking about more treatment and whether you've heard anything about estriol, the pregnancy hormone.
Oh, yeah, estriol. Yeah, there's a study going on about that. And of course, it's going to have to be combined with progesterone to be used long term, because it would have an effect on the uterus to be on estradiol all the time. That goes way up. That's the highest estrogen drug or molecule during pregnancy. Of course, because people have noticed that people during the last part of pregnancy don't tend to get flare-ups of their MS, they thought there was a protective effect, and it may be the estradiol. And I think a preliminary study did show that it decreased certain parameters of MS in a stage 2 trial with a few patients. So I think it's in trial right now, but I don't know the final result. I think it may be on that list at government clinicaltrials.gov. You could look on there and see. But it hasn't been reported out yet, to my knowledge.
Kelly, this is Leanne. Can you tell me how many calls are left, how many questions are left in the queue?
One moment. We have 16.
Okay, so Dr. Cook, I'm going to leave this up to you. We're 10 minutes over our schedule, so there's 16 questions in the queue. How many more do you feel taking?
Okay, well, I want to be fair, but yeah, I should get home and see my wife here too. Why don't we do 5 more questions?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Karen. Karen, you may begin.
Hey, doctor.
Hello.
Try and be real quick. Vitamin D. I just talked to my my doctor is retired, and I've had 2 replacements in the last year, family nurse practitioners. But I questioned her because I was reading about vitamin D and talking to my daughter about the necessity for her to start taking it. And I said to myself, well, D, is it D3, D2, D5? And I looked at my prescription for $50,000 a week, and it's listed as D2, I believe. And I thought, why wouldn't they have prescribed D3? And so
I think, I'm not an expert on this, but I think the bigger formulation, the $50,000, is metabolized a different way. For the oral drug, it's the one you get at the grocery store, even for $1,000 or $2,000. I've been told, and I'm not a pharmacologist, that D3 is absorbed better than the one you're talking about. I know some people to prevent osteoporosis take that 50,000 unit one once a week, and it's something to do with the metabolism of it. Your body converts vitamin D into different forms until it reaches its active form. But the general recommendation for the pills orally is the over-the-counter ones, because yours is prescription, is D3 because of better absorption. And I think there's probably a variance in the different brands. You know, the Walmart may be different effect than the Rite Aid one, because I have people on the same dose, and some of them have good blood levels and others have borderline. Of course, I don't know. Maybe they forget to take it, or who knows. Or they just absorb it differently, or they're on a different diet. But that's the best I can answer you on that. But I know what you're saying here, that it's not D3.
Our next question comes from Lauren. Lauren, you may begin.
Go ahead.
Lauren, you may begin. Our next question comes from Mary Lou. Mary Lou, you may begin.
Hello, doctor. I've already been talking a little bit with this, but I think you already answered my question, but I think what you were saying is maybe Copaxone is the next drug for me to take after 16 years of Avonex. Do you think that would be right?
Well, the only thing that you may not like is that Copaxone's every day, and Avonex is once a week, and Copaxone's under the skin, and the other is in the muscle. Depends on how your skin reacts to it. Of course, you have to talk to your prescribing physician about all this, too. I can tell you that there's a study going on to maybe cut the frequency of the dose of Copaxone down to 3 times a week, but at a higher dose. And there is a study out of Detroit, Omar Khan's group at Wayne State, that every other day Copaxone may work just as well as daily, which would be a blessing to people who want to take it every day. That would be the big thing you're going to notice. Plus, the side effects are different. Some people on Copaxone, even though it usually has less side effects than interferon, can feel kind of anxious or have a funny feeling in their chest. It's uncommon, but occasionally I hear that. I would say in general it's well tolerated, though. And it's quite safe. It's probably the safest drug. You don't have to monitor liver function or anything with Copaxone.
Our next question comes from Anita. Anita, you may begin.
Hello?
Yes, Dr. Cook, my question has to do about an MRI. I had an MRI here about 6 or 8 months ago. The results have not been read yet, but it was considered to be like a baseline because I've had MS for about 25 years and hadn't had an MRI for a long time. What is it, given the long term of my MS, that you might be looking for in me? I have not been on any MS drugs for years. I've tried Betaseron, the Avonex briefly, and I did the Navantrone. Like I say, I've been on nothing for a few years. What would you be looking for at this time?
Yeah, the only reason I do scans in your situation is to see if there's new activity. So I would want to use enhancement there, gadolinium enhancement. Every now and then I'm fooled. Someone will tell me, well, I haven't had a flare-up in many, many years, and their last two MRI scans have been normal, but maybe they haven't had one for a few years, and they want to go off treatment, and go off Avonex or whatever it is. And I can remember very distinctly a nice lady who was in that situation. We did the scan, and lo and behold, she had enhancing lesions. So I told her, well, I would stay on your Avonex, even though you're 70-some years old and have had MS for 30 years. Like I said earlier, some experts, like Dr. O'Connor in Toronto and Canada, who runs a big MS clinic at the University of Toronto, they suggest even that people go off these drugs after stability of 7 years. You know, if they've had no clinical attacks and their MRIs are stable, they can go off drug. But in general, I would say the vast majority of MS specialists, especially in the United States, tend to keep people on because we think there's probably some subclinical smoldering inflammation going on in the gray matter that you don't see. The MRI scans aren't perfect. They're pretty sensitive. But if you do big magnets, 7 Tesla magnets, you know, much bigger than the 1.5 Tesla magnets that are usually used for MRIs, you can see these lesions in the gray matter that aren't ordinarily seen. But on the other hand, I've seen people, I've been impressed for many years, I've seen people do very well without any treatment. You know, I diagnosed them way before these drugs came on the market, and they were stable, and they didn't really want to have the injections or spend the money, and they didn't go on immunologic drugs, and they still have done well. I've had a few that eventually did get some symptoms. You know, their gait got impaired, their thinking ability slowed, but they're still functional. They're living independently. It's just such a strange disease. It's so variable. There's just a broad spectrum. You'll see everything from people in wheelchairs and really impaired to people that don't even know they have MS. There's a condition called radiologic isolated syndrome where the MRIs look very much like MS, but the patient has no symptoms. And if you follow these people, some of them will convert and eventually get symptoms. But I'm sure there are many people out there that probably have a form of MS and don't even know they have it.
Our last question comes from Renee. Renee, you may begin.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess, I don't know. Whoops. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great. Okay. I live in a rural area of Pendleton, Oregon, if you know where that is. And to get to my neurologist, it's in Portland. You know, it's a 3.5-hour drive, and it's a lot of money to stay in hotels and everything. And I've had two different doctors tell me opposite things, primary care physicians. One said it doesn't matter, you have to see a neurologist with MS because treatments are changing all the time. My current doctor is saying, no, we could just go old school and I'll treat your symptoms, and, you know, if we need to, we'll do the steroids. It's a big question, and it's a weird one for a neurologist, but do you think that it's, like, okay not to go to a neurologist if you have MS? I mean, if there's nothing really that they're going to do except put you on Copaxone anyway.
Well, it's a changing field. There's a lot of research going on. And like I said, there's these new drugs being developed, and there's new symptomatic drugs being developed. I think it's worthwhile to see an expert in MS periodically. You don't have to use them all the time, but maybe once a year or at least every other year, go see the neurologist that you saw originally or whoever you prefer, maybe at a medical school or an MS clinic or just the local neurologist that's interested in MS, and just review the situation, because sometimes there's a good idea that comes out of that and it may change the way you treat yourself. Otherwise, sure, I think the daily treatments, the bladder infections, that sort of thing, if your family doctor has an interest in MS, there's certainly a lot of books about MS and in general medical books too, and he can always call an MS expert and ask them what he would do. That's what I do myself. If I'm not sure about something, I call someone at a big center and say, I don't have experience with this, can you advise me? So if you have a really good primary doc, I would assume they do the same thing. I hope that helps.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. Cook, for your time and for your great information. I'm sorry that we can't get to all of the questions tonight, but I'm afraid we might not get through this call. So thank you, everyone, for your interest and for joining this teleconference call. And thank you so much, Dr. Cook, for your great information.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for listening.
All right. We wish everyone a great night, and we will be sending you the follow-up email.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.